This episode is brought to you in association with Janus Henderson Investors. It's for promotional purposes only, is not for forward distribution, and the value of an investment can fall as well as rise. Past performance is not a guide to future performance, and nothing in this episode should be construed as advice. Our discussion is for illustrative purposes only, and references made to individual securities should not constitute or form part of any offer or solicitation to issue, sell, subscribe, or purchase the security. Hello, and welcome to Trust Radio, the investment trust podcast hosted by Janus Henderson Investors, where we take a deep dive into the questions investors really want to know the answers to. My name is Andrew Chiguri, and today I'm joined by Jamie Ross, portfolio manager of Henderson Euro Trust, to discuss how the trust has performed year to date, the challenges European investors are facing, and how he's navigating these challenges and how companies are adapting to stay competitive. Jamie, welcome to the show.
Hi, Andrew.
Now, Jamie, European markets, especially growth stocks, have struggled to begin the year, and that's been due to high inflation and the prospect of high interest rates as well. And the war in Ukraine has also weighed on sentiment towards Europe. How are you currently navigating this market environment?
Yes, it's, as you say, it's a very difficult market environment, in particular for those strategies that follow a kind of a growth or a quality focus. So it's been tough for us. In terms of, you know, what we do about it and how we navigate this situation, the most important thing for me is that you must not change from your process. You must not change from the style and the strategy that your shareholders expect you to follow. So that is at the back of my mind all of the time. So, you know, the primary thing is that we will stick to our mantra of growth, quality, and consistency. You know, we will seek to continue to own high quality businesses, continue to own high return businesses, whether or not that particular type of company is in favor at the moment. So that is the most important thing. The second thing I'd say is that this is not an environment for companies who have low pricing power and as a proxy, low gross profit margins. So that's something we are always focused on, but something that in particular at the moment we've been very acutely focused on. And we've made sure that we've been, you know, over the last, you know, 4 or 5 months, been through the portfolio, make sure that we are comfortable that the companies have the degree of pricing power that we would like. And we've made a few changes to remove from the portfolio some of our lower gross profit margin or lower pricing power businesses. Mm. The second thing we've done is, you know, as I said earlier, we must stick to growth, quality, and consistency. That has to be at the forefront of what we do. But there can be nuances to that. And, you know, with inflation kind of really seeming to become sustainable at higher levels now, and with interest rates rising, it makes it a very, very tough environment for that subsector of the growth part of the market whose returns are generated many years from now. Mm. So I would refer to that subsector as kind of long duration growth. Yeah. And, you know, in this environment, you know, we would far rather own a business that's generating strong returns, strong profit margins and strong, you know, strong profit today, mm-hmm. rather than one who could do in 10 years time. So again, that's a slight tweak, and we've been reducing our exposure, and in fact have been really over the last 12 to 18 months, yeah. reducing our exposure to that subset of growth. So those are the things we've been doing. Stick to what we do, stick to our process, but make some tweaks to suit the environment.
You say that finding quality companies is the best way to navigate an uncertain market. What kind of attributes are you looking for? I mean, you talked about pricing power there, for example, but what other characteristics are you looking for in these businesses?
I mean, ultimately, the analytical focus, if you're going to boil it down to one thing, it is understanding the return on invested capital of the businesses we invest in or are looking at. And as hopefully the listeners will know, there are two types of companies we invest in, those that we call compounders and those that we call improvers. And the compounders are businesses that earn a high return on invested capital that we believe is sustainable. And we often find that over a very long period of time, when you look at the returns of these businesses as a shareholder, they appear to be expensive when you first look at them. But if you own them for a long period of time, the returns to shareholders can be very, very strong. crucially, we have to be right with those compounders that return on investor capital, or ROIC, is going to stay high.
Yeah.
You know, if you invest in a business whose returns are high today and tomorrow they're not so high, you're going to see a very big derating. So that's the first thing we do, the compounders. The second, improvers. Improvers are businesses where the return on investor capital today might not be that high, but there's something about that business or that industry that suggests to us that in X years' time, the return on investor capital of that business or industry will be better. And we try to invest in those stories of improvement as well. So when we talk about quality, think return on investor capital and think ROIC. And those are the two types of opportunity that we would look at.
Even though it's been a tough time for European stocks, this now means that European stocks are trading at a discount compared to their US peers. Has this provided you with any opportunities to buy stocks at more reasonable valuations?
Yeah, absolutely. The first thing I say is that we have to be long-term here. So, you know, although performance in the short term is difficult and there's no hiding from that, that also creates opportunities because there's a good reason why performance in the short term isn't good. And a good chunk of that is because of the underperformance of the type of businesses we want to own. So what happens if, you know, those growthy quality companies lose 20% of their share price or lose 30% or 40% even in some occasions, and we think that those businesses are maybe not really facing anything that is dramatically changing the outlook, we can buy more. So it's painful for short-term performance because the things we like are going down. But if every cloud has a silver lining, that is the silver lining. We can buy more of the companies that we really like. We can deploy more capital of the trust into those opportunities. And for us, that has included two things. You know, firstly, adding more to existing high conviction positions, some of which we've owned for multiple years, and I've got an opportunity to build up positions in. And the second thing we've done is we have looked around and tried to find new opportunities. To give you some specific examples then, I'll give a couple, but more than happy to talk about, you know, any of the positions we've initiated in recently. The two I would talk about are UMG and Sartorius. So UMG, a company we've recently published on to outline our thoughts, which you can find on the website. This is a very high quality company. UMG are effectively a music content owner. There are three large players globally, of which UMG is the largest. Those three players together, which is Warner, Music, Sony, and UMG, own around 75% of the music in circulation. So when we listen to our Spotify subscriptions, you know, 7 out of every 10 songs are owned by those three players. So very consolidated, oligopolistic market of music ownership. And if we think about how those content owners get their music to market, I mentioned Spotify, you know, obviously there are other, as we would call them, DSPs, the digital service providers. That is a much more fragmented market.
Mm.
And that gives UMG and the other big content owners a very good position for bargaining, a very good position of pricing power. And on the other side of things, the artists, that's an even more fragmented market.
Yeah.
And as every day goes by, it becomes more and more fragmented. Just to give you one example of the challenge faced by a musician. If we go back 20 years, there are around 2 million songs a year released. That number's now tenfold. You know, so to stand above the crowd is increasingly difficult.
Yeah.
And for me, the role of the players like UMG is becoming more important rather than less important. So a very strong market position. And then there's growth as well. So if we think about the growth opportunities, there's two things I'd point to. Firstly, you'll notice if you have a Spotify subscription that the price has never gone up. There is some latent pricing power that we think will start to feed through once the industry matures in the more mature markets that it operates in. And then in some of the less developed markets, and we would point to parts of Asia, notably China, Brazil, these markets, music subscriptions are very underpenetrated.
Yeah.
So there's a big opportunity for volume growth in the developing world and for pricing-led growth eventually in the more developed world. So a very strong business. The second one I mentioned was Sartorius. Sartorius for me is one of these opportunities that doesn't come along that often, where a high-quality business that, in our view, if anything, the end market conditions are improving rather than getting worse, has derated from what we saw admittedly as a too high valuation 6 months ago of around 60 times PE, 60. It's derated to 30. And this is a very high quality provider of equipment to the biologics, to the biopharma industry. The biopharma industry is growing very quickly, is gaining share from other means of drug production, is a very defensive growth profile. And again, Sartorius operate in a fairly consolidated oligopolistic position. And the most important thing about the business model is the fact that if you are Roche or you are another large biopharma company, the importance of producing a biologic or a biosimilar drug that is clean, that is consistent, that is safe to use, and whose production profile runs smoothly, the importance of that is so big to the business and so important to your credibility and your reputation that gives someone like Sartorius, who provide the kit, really strong pricing power. Mm. You know, Roche are not going to argue too hard about the price of a filter that they use in their production processes when it is so critical to the quality of the end product.
Yeah.
So again, a very high quality business strategy.
Interesting. Now, the war in Ukraine has had a massive impact on markets. And, you know, this has exacerbated some of the issues stemming from the COVID-19 pandemic. So far, companies have been able to pass on costs to consumers, and this has helped alleviate some of those rising input costs. What are you hearing from your portfolio companies about these rising costs? Are margins being squeezed, and what is the key to sustaining these margins?
Yeah, we certainly are hearing a lot about this topic, and it's clearly a topic that we will raise with all of the companies we speak to, those that we own and those that we don't own. And, you know, in summary, there is very clear inflationary pressures across the board. I touched on it earlier, but in this environment, and when I say in this environment, I don't mean today or the next month or the next, you know, I expect this environment to last for a little while, maybe a year or multi-year period of higher inflation. In this environment, you need companies that have high gross profit margins and have an ability to pass on cost increases. And to have high pricing power, you need, I mean, it's very multifaceted, but, you know, you could have a very strong market position like Sartorius that I described. You could be providing a product that is absolutely essential to your customer. Again, Sartorius is an example of that to some extent. You could be doing something that consumers gain an intangible benefit from. That's a slightly less obvious example. You know, when we buy, not that I particularly do, but a Birkin bag or something for you know, 12,000 euros, that bag is not worth 12,000 euros. That bag is only worth 12,000 euros because that particular consumer has an intangible value they put on it.
Mm.
And if that intangible value led by the brand and the heritage is strong enough and is powerful enough, then that gives pricing power. So that I could go on and give many different examples of how pricing power is gained. But, you know, in an environment of rising costs, that's what we need to focus on. Businesses that can pass on pricing, and businesses that who, by having a high gross profit margin, that means that the COGS, the cost of goods sold, is a smaller proportion of revenues than those with a low gross profit margin. So that's a really important point to consider. We want high pricing power. We want high gross margin businesses.
You mentioned intangible value there, which is something which is quite interesting, because though consumers have saved up during the pandemic, the cost of living has also risen significantly over the last few months. Now, that means consumers have less disposable income. Has this changed the opportunity set that you're looking at all?
It does. And there are certain areas that, you know, we would become less comfortable on, and some areas that we, I suppose, would become more comfortable on. And there are probably more of the former than the latter. You know, this is a difficult environment. And there are certain areas of the market that we think will struggle, and we think we're starting to see the first signs of that. I mean, there's been a raft of disappointing updates or profit warnings from US retail-focused companies, both in online and offline. So clearly the consumer is getting squeezed, and that is starting to impact. So in this kind of environment, I suppose what you want is either consumer staple items So, you know, does this concern us with regards to Nestle, which we've got a big position in selling, you know, selling pet food and coffee? Mm-hmm. Yes, I mean they're gonna face issues like many companies, but we are slightly less concerned about the likes of Nestle that are selling pretty essential products. Mm. And incidentally, on pet food, a lot of evidence has shown that it's one of the last things consumers cut. You know, they'd almost rather cut their own food budget than their darling pooch's, you know, food basket. So, you know, there's going to be squeezing across the board. What are we most concerned about? Well, autos is one area we would look at, and that's something that we have had some exposure to in our improvers part of the portfolio over the last few years. And that is something that we've cut quite a bit over the last 12 months. Mm. And the reason is twofold. Firstly, this is proper consumer discretionary items. You know, your car is really, in some cases, it's optional. You know, if you live in a city center or something, less so for families, obviously. But the make and the brand and the cost of your car is certainly, you know, an intangible benefit that we think can get squeezed.
Yeah.
You know, I think the degree of pricing power there is low. The second aspect of autos that we find troublesome, and this has been the case for many years, but if you go back several decades ago, autos were bought in cash generally. You know, you went and bought your car with cash, and that has changed massively, partly because of the low rate environment that we've been in for so long, partly because of newer financing products that have come to market over the last 20 years. But in the US and the UK, as examples, the vast majority of new cars are purchased with financing. So in an environment where interest rates are going up and the consumer's getting squeezed, that doesn't feel too good to us. That doesn't feel like an area we want large exposure to. So, you know, we're definitely trying to avoid those areas of more acute concern. Luxury, I mentioned Hermes earlier. Luxury is an area that we have actually maintained exposure to. You know, often the slightly unfair result of tough economic environment, it's the lower income part of the economy that struggles more. Always seems very unfair, but luxury goods companies, there will be cyclicality, but generally maybe less than you'd imagine. So we've maintained exposure there. And the other aspect here is it highlights our long-term approach. You know, we own Hermes because it is a super high ROIC business. Like, that brand heritage is very hard to usurp. So again, as with anything, it's a nuanced approach. Yes, we're hearing a lot about rising costs and about inflation, but you know, we have to pick the companies we'll invest in and those that we want to reduce exposure to.
One of the things companies are doing to deal with some of these rising costs is to move some of their production or manufacturing closer to home, you know, which some people are calling nearshoring. Are you seeing this trend within Europe? And what are you hearing from your portfolio companies about supply chain resilience?
We're definitely seeing companies talk about this, and we're seeing some evidence that it's not just talk, that it is action that they will be taking. And so we expect that to be a feature of the market. In terms of supply chains, it's a very difficult topic, actually. The last 18 months have seen very unpredictable and longer lasting issues for the supply chain of many different industries than any of us would have expected. Mm. And when we look at the current situation today, we can see pockets of supply chain issues that we think are improving, are starting to improve. So the auto industry, semiconductor-led supply chain shortages, that appears to starting to ease up a little bit. Incidentally, that's not necessarily a good thing for the auto industry, but we can see that in some cases. But other areas seem to be getting worse and have been very heavily impacted by Russia, Ukraine.
Yeah.
You know, as an example, titanium. You know, a fairly niche product, a niche you know, kind of raw material that actually is used a lot in the civil aerospace supply chain where we have some exposure to. That's been heavily disrupted by what's going on. So it just highlights, you know, there are these little pockets that in quite unpredictable ways supply chains have been impacted. And then, you know, the recovery from these supply chain constraints will be uneven and quite hard to predict. Again, it goes without saying, you know, what do we try and do? We try and own resilient companies. We try and own businesses that aren't hugely dependent on, you know, on one particular raw material. There's larger companies that really think about supply chains in a forward-thinking way and have set up multiple sources for how they get their raw materials. So it's a very difficult topic and sometimes quite hard to invest around, but one that we're certainly hearing from all the companies we invest in.
Switching back to the trust, you are now a light green fund under EU SFDR regulation. What does this mean for the trust?
When I think about Eurotrust, you know, over the last 20 plus years, we have always been a strategy that is focused on quality. And for, you know, that for me has always gone hand in hand with the idea that if you invest in what you see as a high return on invested capital business where returns are sustainable longer term, you are investing in the type of business who thinks long term and acts long term. And that goes hand in hand with businesses that are better than average when it comes to environmental considerations or social considerations. It's not always the case, but generally our strategy in the past has biased us towards that type of company. So why did we move to a light green designation? Firstly, our interactions with shareholders have become, you know, much more focused on this topic. Shareholders no longer want to just work out how we're going to make good returns over time, but they want to ensure that the money they're being invested is being invested in what they would see as the right way. So, you know, the focus has to be on not just long-term returns, which are absolutely what we're aiming to do, long-term total return more attractive than the market, but to invest in the right way. And the move, so that's really why we've gone down this route. But the changes we've made are really, I see them as red lines, really, that we're putting into our investment process, just to highlight to investors and to shareholders what we will and what we will not do. So just to make it really, really clear and on paper, make it a formalization, really, of of an existing process. So, for example, you know, one of the things is that, you know, we will no longer invest in tobacco. I can't remember ever investing in tobacco for Eurotrust. It's not been something that we would usually look at. And the reasons for that are that, you know, if you think about long-term sustainability of demand for a company, if you're selling a product that is harming your customers, that's not an ideal starting point for that. So a lot of these changes are really formalizing existing parts of our process and strategy and how we do things. So that for me is the most important thing. These are red lines. It's a formalization of things. There is no huge change to what we are doing and the process that we're following.
One thing the war in Ukraine has highlighted is the importance of that transition towards cleaner energy. However, higher oil prices at the moment suggest that this transition might take a lot longer than expected. What's your take on that?
I mean, it's one of the real conundrums of this environment, isn't it? For a number of years, and with growing intensity in Europe and in other regions, we're trying to move to a, you know, a more renewable led energy source, more, you know, more generally across the board, and cut down on emissions and you know, think about the environment much more. But we're faced with the reality that in Europe we derive a lot of our you know, a lot of our energy source comes from Russia. We could talk for hours about, you know, geopolitical mistakes of the past, probably not within the scope of this podcast, but that is the situation we're in. So how do we deal with it? You know, in the short term, it is fairly clear to me that we will see a worse outcome for the environment in the very short term. We need to sweat existing assets harder, and a lot of those existing assets are not that clean. LNG is an area that probably needs to be looked at and will be. But that's the short term. You know, that is what we do about this situation now, the kind of acute problem. The chronic problem is what we do over the next 10 to 15 years. And when I think about investment strategy, I'm certainly not going to be chasing that former thing. So, you know, we're not looking around trying to find trying to boost our exposure to oil and LNG for several obvious reasons. What we are trying to do is think, what is the long-term solution here and how can we benefit from that? The long-term solution for me, unequivocally, is more renewable energy capacity in Europe. There are various regulations and bureaucratic processes that slow down the growth in capacity within the renewable sector. And that needs to be addressed at the permitting process, for one. We need real effort within Europe to allow renewable capacity to be laid down more quickly, more effectively. And that is something that we can invest behind.
Hmm.
And we can do that by investing in renewable energy companies themselves. We can invest in the supply chain. Our personal view is that within the supply chain, we talked about gross profit margins earlier and pricing power. There is limited pricing power and there is lower business quality. And then within the actual capacity players themselves, so the people who own, operate, and bid for, you know, wind farms and solar farms, there are some great companies in Europe that are very well positioned. And in recent years, there's been a lot of concern about growing competition, if you're an Ørsted or an EDPR, you know, growing competition, especially from the oil companies who want to get into renewable energy. You know, if we're moving to a situation where the legislation in Europe is going to be freed up somewhat to allow more capacity to be added, that alleviates that concern somewhat. So we think that there is a very good medium-term story in some of the things that we can invest in Europe, one of which is EDPR, which is a relatively new position for us that we initiated in kind of February, March time. So there will be opportunities, but there's a big difference between trying to work out what's going to do well over 6 months and trying to work out what's going to do well over 5 years.
Mm.
We're much more focused on the latter than the former.
Lastly, how do you retain conviction in your strategy when experiencing a very tough market environment as we're doing now?
It is something that's tough. I mean, you always question yourself, and I think it would be negligent if I didn't question myself and my approach. But the fact is that I have a strong, long-held belief that if you own a high return on invested capital business for a long period of time and returns are sustainable, that's the big if. That's where the work comes in, trying to find those where returns will be sustainable.
Hmm.
Then you will make good money for your shareholders over time, and we'll stick with that process. And just to maybe finish on, a few numbers to put around that premise that I've just put in front of you. If you imagine, and please bear with me, there's a few numbers here, but if you imagine a high quality business, a notional high quality business delivering a 20% return on invested capital, and what we're then going to imagine is that business can reinvest behind growth over the next 10 years. So a high return business with opportunities to deploy capital. That business, even if you assume a derating, so let's assume we bought it at 20 times earnings, and over that 10 years it derates to 15 times, which might make sense if interest rates are going up. Even in that situation, over the 10 years, you will have received a 17% share price compound annual growth rate from owning that company, even with it derating from 20 times to 15 times. And if it derated from 25 times to 15 times over that 10-year period, you'll get a 14% CAGR. Incidentally, that would be probably double the usual market CAGR. So if, and it's a big if, you can find a high return business where returns are sustainable, whether you are paying 20 times or 25 times or 15 times, and whether or not it derates a bit, if you have the patience to invest behind it over the long term, you'll make money from it if you are right in your analysis. And just to throw more numbers into the mix, if you think about a low quality company, let's do the opposite. So if you think about a 5% return on invested capital business, of which there are numerous in Europe and other markets, and you own that for 10 years, let's imagine it doubles in valuation. So it goes from a PE of 5 to a PE of 10. You'll get a 13% CAGR. So incidentally, slightly less than the two CAGRs I laid out for you for that high quality company that is derated.
Hmm.
Doubles in valuation, this value company, and you still make only a 13% CAGR. If the valuation stays the same, so doesn't move at all, not derates, just stays the same, you get a 5% CAGR. Your return will be the same as the return on invested capital of that business. So those are some illustrative numbers that that highlight why we do what we do, which is to try and find high return businesses where those returns are going to be sustainable over a long period of time.
Very interesting. Well, Jamie, that's all we have time for today. Thank you very much for joining us.
Thanks, Andrew.
And thank you for listening. If you enjoyed this podcast, please subscribe, rate, review, and share this with anyone you think will also find this interesting. If you want to learn more about investment trusts, we have a wealth of information available on our website, which you can find in the show notes.
Important information, not for onward distribution. Before investing in an investment trust referred to in this podcast, you should satisfy yourself as to its suitability and the risks involved. You may wish to consult a financial advisor. This is a marketing communication. Please refer to the AIFMD disclosure document and the annual reports of the AIF before making any final investment decisions. Past performance does not predict future returns. The value of an investment and the income from it can fall as well as rise, and you may not get back the amount you originally invested. Tax assumptions and reliefs depend upon an investor's particular circumstances and may change if those circumstances or the law change. Nothing in this podcast is intended to or should be construed as advice. This podcast is not a recommendation to sell or purchase any investment. It does not form part of any contract for the sale or purchase of any investment. We may record telephone calls for our mutual protection, to improve customer service, and for the regulatory record keeping purposes. Issued in the UK by Janus Henderson Investors. Janus Henderson Investors is the name under which investment products and services are provided by Janus Henderson Investors International Limited. Reg number 3594615. Janus Henderson Investors UK Limited. Reg number 906355. Janus Henderson Fund Management UK Limited. Reg number 2678531. Henderson Equity Partners Limited, Reg number 2606646. Each registered in England and Wales at 201 Bishopsgate in London, EC2M3AE, and regulated by the Financial Conduct Authority. And Henderson Management S.A, Reg number B22848. At 2 Rue de Bitburg, L1273, Luxembourg, and regulated by the Commission de Surveillance du Secteur Financier. Janus Henderson, Knowledge Shared and Knowledge Labs are trademarks of Janus Henderson Group PLC or one of its subsidiaries. Copyright Janus Henderson Group PLC.
Compound annual growth rate is the rate of return that will be required for an investment to grow from its beginning balance to its ending balance, assuming the profits were reinvested at the end of each period of the investment's lifespan. Inflation, the rate at which prices of goods and services are rising in an economy. The CPI and RPI are two common measures. Duration. Duration is a measure of the sensitivity of the price of a bond or other debt instruments to change in interest rates. Gross profit margin. The gross profit margin is a metric analysts use to assess a company's financial health by calculating the money left over from the product sales after subtracting the cost of goods, also known as COGS. Price to earnings ratio, also known as PE. The PE ratio shows what the market is willing to pay today for a stock based on its past or future earnings. A high PE ratio could mean that a stock's price is high relative to earnings and is possibly overvalued. Conversely, a low PE might indicate that the current stock price is low relative to earnings. Value investing. Value investors search for companies that they believe are undervalued by the market and therefore expect their share price to increase. One of the favorite techniques is to buy companies with low price to earnings ratios. Return on invested capital. ROIC. ROIC is a profitability ratio used to indicate how effective a company is at turning capital into profits. Return on investment, ROI. ROI is a measure of performance used to evaluate the efficiency or profitability of an investment, or compare the efficiency of a number of different